told his tale. And I will tell you mine.
Well, welcome back, everybody, to Take Me to Your Reader, discussing adapted science fiction at its best and worst. I'm Seth.
I'm James.
And I'm Colin.
And this time, well, if you cast your mind back almost exactly 10 years, we were recording on essentially the first anniversary of recording our first episode. And we, back in those days, we didn't really think about the fact that we could milk topics for multiple episodes the way we do now. And so we did an episode on Frankenstein. And we watched a whole lot of stuff. And we briefly covered all of it, you know, in a little over an hour, I think.
Hour and a half. And we did the book and seven movies.
Yes.
We did seven movies?
Well, Boris Karloff, Bride of Frankenstein, Young Frankenstein, Kenneth Branagh, the 2004 miniseries.
Victor Frankenstein.
That's right.
Victor Frankenstein, yeah. I, Frankenstein. Right, right. The 1910, which was mentioned but never fully covered.
Yeah, yeah. The Thomas Edison one. Yeah.
Yes, and some book.
Right.
Right.
That it might be based off of.
The best part of that, though, was...
Freaking overachievers over here.
Yeah. Sheesh. Well, no, just being dumb about not splitting it into two episodes.
Yeah.
Touche.
Or several episodes. We could have done a year on Frankenstein.
Franken series.
Yeah, exactly.
Or a Christmas Carol.
Yeah. I mean, what better to piece together an entire series than Frankenstein, right?
But... nice.
But in that discussion, we talked about Victor Frankenstein, right? And Colin made this offhanded comment because we were talking about like the dark universe or the universal thing. And he's like, maybe they'll reboot it in another 10 years. And so here we are 10 years later.
Thank you, Guillermo del Toro.
Yes. And so there is a new episode or a new adaptation of Frankenstein that's dropping on Netflix in November.
Right.
We're sitting here a week before Halloween, and it is in limited release in theaters. It happened that it came to one not far from us, and so we went out there and watched it, and we're going to talk about it and where it falls kind of in the pantheon of Frankenstein adaptations, and yeah.
And hope that Guillermo del Toro reboots the monster universe?
Pretty much, yes.
Yeah.
I mean, probably not a bad idea to just rip the Band-Aid off. Since it is in theaters for limited release, it might not be in theaters for very long.
No, I think it was last week and this week. Came out the 17th and goes and leaves probably today or might be there through October. You'd have to check.
Yeah, yeah. Check your local listings.
Yes.
Yeah, look in your newspaper for the theater listings.
Oh, yeah.
I remember doing that. Yeah, I really liked it.
It was...
Yeah. I thought it was the adaptation we should have had 10 years ago.
Right.
It is without a doubt the most... So, you know, I had this idea a long time ago that I never, ever did, which was to graph the perceived quality of a movie against its canonicity.
Yes.
Right? Mm-hmm. And what we've found out over the last 12 or 13 years is there's really no correlation. Right. You can make really canonical movies that suck, and you can take the idea from something and make a great movie out of it that is only barely related to the original. Mm-hmm. This movie, I think, is the best canonical movie adaptation I have ever seen.
Okay.
Right up there with The Martian and a few others. I mean, it's just...
Okay.
I mean, we're missing one crucial point of canonicity.
Well, there's a number of points of canonicity that are different. So we can talk through some of those. So obviously, we're all recommending it. So go out and watch it if
Fantastic
you can.
Movie. Yeah.
And I re-listened to our episode that we did all those years ago. And I also listened to the audiobook. I remember telling you guys I had from Chirp Audiobooks at some point, there was a $1.99, two horror classics, and it was Dracula and Frankenstein. And Chirp,
nice.
You can do a better job with your interface showing me how to play one of the books versus the other. I had to search through the chapters, and the chapters are just titled with the first few words of the chapter.
Oh my gosh.
Every now and then it would say like chapter two. Or
so whatever. Which book was first?
But the tracks would just show the words
right
on it. And so Frankenstein was first.
Oh, okay.
So when I went back to listen to it, I had to go back to the beginning to listen to Frankenstein, right. And then I got through to the other side, and now I've listened to the whole thing. But it's just a little annoying that was the way it was done. But it was a good audio version, and I liked reviewing kind of what was in the book. So I can be the canonicity guy.
Sure.
And talk about the things that it changed. And of course, you know that I'm coming from the place of I don't care.
Oh, yeah, no, totally.
If the movie works, then I've got no beef with it, especially since, you know, I don't really need a faithful Frankenstein adaptation. The 2004 miniseries was pretty straight adaptation. It wasn't awesome.
It wasn't very good either.
Yeah. And so at this point, I'm just kind of like, let somebody take it and rewrite it and do emphasize certain things, right? Or redirect a couple things. Because one of the problems that you had with the book originally was you just found the monster kind of whiny. Or just like how long it took him to go through his whole sordid tale and get to everything. And then, of course, he murdered a lot of people. So it made him less sympathetic.
Yeah, I didn't like anybody in the book.
Yeah. So here we have Del Toro adapting this, and he wrote it for the screen. Mm-hmm. So I imagine he had other people that he wrote it with as well. Mm-hmm. But he makes some serious changes in it where I'm like, he made the monster more sympathetic and made Victor much less sympathetic.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
So, you know, I still think that you can read the story, the book, with an unreliable narrator, and it's Victor Frankenstein playing both roles.
Yes.
And there was the stage play that came out about the same time we recorded this where...
Oh, with Johnny Miller and...
Benedict Cumberbatch. Yeah. And they would alternate roles.
Yeah.
Or they would trade off roles. So they had played both roles. And so you'd have to know them both pretty, pretty well. Huh. Mm-hmm. Which, wow. I thought I would love to see. I'd love to see both of those.
That'd happen. Be trippy.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, Victor Frankenstein is an anti-hero in the book. Mm-hmm. And the monster is his victim who makes bad choices. You know, he doesn't have a lot of good role models in his life.
Right. Right.
So he does what he thinks is right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, and the other part of Victor is too, like, people die because Victor keeps all his secrets, right? In this movie, everybody knows what's going on the whole time. Everyone close to him kind of is in on the secret. And so there, all those threads of the monster killing somebody because they didn't know that they might be under threat are just gone away. Right. Like in the book, he tells Elizabeth, look, after our wedding night, I'll tell you everything. He wanted to make sure he got a ring on it before she could run out on him.
That's right.
And then, of course, she's killed on their wedding night. By the monster. Yeah. Yeah. Because at that point, he had failed to follow through on his promise. When I was listening to the book this time, I thought, this is a book about the epidemic of male loneliness and incel culture. like the monster is the original incel, right? Because he says, look, no women will get with me because I'm hideous. So make one for me and everything will be cool.
Yeah.
Damn.
Because apparently the monster can't die.
Right.
I don't know if that's really from the book or not.
It's not necessarily from the book, but the monster doesn't die in the book.
Right. I mean, he goes through an awful lot of things. I mean, in the movie, the monster
what would happen if you cut him up and, like, rather than, I don't know, because I feel like that dynamite should have worked, but.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But what if you were to, like, cut him up and then he'd be, like, precursor to the thing, right? Adam's family.
So, like I said, it makes Victor less sympathetic here in the book. And it shows, you know, obviously, like, from his upbringing, because his father's very cold. In the movie,
sure, mm-hmm.
And very, very demanding, and loves his little brother, right? Yeah. And I guess we're in spoilers now, everybody.
Yep, sorry, you've been warned.
And so, like, it shows, you know, the book talks over and over about how idyllic his family relationships were, because they had Elizabeth, who had come to live with them essentially as a sister. GDT ditched that because. Dude marrying his essentially sister is,
a little weird. Mm-hmm. Yeah, weird. But lusting after your future sister-in-law, that's totally cool.
Totally understandable, yes.
Yes. So, yeah, he was determined to become better than his father, and it pushed him down that path of knowledge and learning, and he went to places where people shouldn't go to learn.
Yeah. Well, and he...
Well, and conquered death, right? Because he was still...
Because of his mother.
Because of his mother dying.
Yeah. So it's similar to the De Niro one in that sense, right? Where his mother's death is this big... Oh, no, it was his brother's death or someone. I can't remember now.
Yeah. They try to give him a motivation for why he wants to create life, aside from just pure...
Not create life, but prevent death. Right?
Yeah, to overcome death.
Because that was the idea. He saw that his dad... failed to save his mother, right? And then she died giving birth to his brother, and he was like, well, I want to keep people from dying now.
Mm-hmm. There was one scene with really bad ADR in it, and it was that scene when he was saying, you know, I'm going to be able to overcome death. Mm. And like his lips did not match it at all. and his fathers didn't either. So that was a bummer. But so let's talk about the cast a little bit here.
Okay.
Because Oscar Isaac as Victor.
Yeah.
Right.
Then you had, oh, I can't remember his brother's name. Gotta look that up.
I might have it.
Charles Dance as Baron Frankenstein, the father.
Right.
Mia Goth, yeah, I awesome. Believe, am I correct, plays a dual role of the mother and Elizabeth? I'm pretty sure. They look strikingly similar, if not.
That might have been the attraction, but I don't think...
That's what I figured. They were
so
going
they did
for
the
something.
Fahrenheit 451 thing there?
Yeah, I think so.
Crazy. I did not write down the brother. We have Jacob Elordi as
the monster
or Adam. And I really appreciate... Oh, so here, while you're looking stuff up, I will talk in Natter in the background. Mm-hmm. I really appreciate all of the nods back to the original book. Because at one point, it calls Frankenstein the modern Prometheus.
Yes.
Right.
Right. Yeah. There was the mention of Adam, which is a name for the character that's come in over the years, because the monster has no name. It's really an it. It is so right. othered because it is different in creation and appearance that only a blind person or a little girl could truly, you know, have an open enough heart to welcome them into their lives.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
And what is his name?
William?
No, sorry.
Jacob? Oscar Isaac? Christoph Waltz.
Christoph Waltz is fantastic.
Yeah.
I love Christoph Waltz.
Although, the movie is 2.5 hours long, and I started thinking, if I were to cut anything from this movie, what would I cut? He's number one.
Yeah, I thought they were going to go a different direction with him, where I did think that at some point, okay, it's going to be his brain in there, and there's some falling out that they had.
Oh, well, that's what he wanted, right?
Yeah, it is what he wanted.
Instead, they got Abby Normal.
Yes.
Right.
Well, his would have been the Abby Normal brain.
Yeah.
Oh, because of the syphilis.
Yeah.
Felix Kemmerer is William.
Right.
I know I've seen him in something else, but I'm not totally sure what. David Bradley, Filch from the Harry Potter movies, played the blind man.
Okay.
And then Lars Mikkelsen, who was the boat captain.
Yes.
The Danish boat captain.
Yep. So,
yeah. We're all over the place just because, you know, we just saw it. We have not, it's not like we've gotten to take down a bunch of notes or anything. it's kind of a terrific cast. Jacob Elordi's been in a lot of stuff recently. He was in Saltburn recently, and he's really tall, and so like he lends himself well to the monster.
Well, and his physical acting is really impressive as well.
The art design, the makeup, the costuming is all terrific.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The music
was really good too.
I really like the music they had, 'cause the part when they're doing all the surgery. Taking the bodies apart, putting them back together. Right? It was all very uppity, like uplifting music, and like
over this really
happy,
gross stuff,
you know, uplifting music. And they're like they're sawing apart legs and
arms, hands.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. The juxtaposition of music to what was actually happening on the screen was fantastic.
Yeah, that was good.
any guess as to the budget for this movie?
Ooh.
I mean, I would have guessed it was high just because the production values were so good.
100-ish plus?
200?
150.
Wow. 150, okay.
And so I started to think, where did all that money go? And there's a metric butt ton of CGI in here. Yeah. Between all the, you know, the partially dead animations and the explosions and the backgrounds and everything else.
Yeah.
Right.
The wolves, I think, were all CG.
The wolves were probably all CG. Yeah.
No animals were harmed than to make this movie.
Yeah. Like the underwater scenes, that's probably all CG.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But, and I thought the acting was really good. I liked everybody in their roles. You know, accent work was good. I don't know why Oscar Isaac sounded English, even though he was... Oh, that's right, because they sent him to England.
Yes.
They sent him to Scotland.
Yeah, England and Scotland.
Edinburgh.
Yeah. I forgot about that. So that actually does make sense.
Yeah.
Like all the... pieces fit together really, really nicely to make a really, really lovingly done film, right?
Yeah.
And then, so we can talk about the writing, right, in terms of the story on screen as it compares to the book, because it does, like I said, make some changes because Victor is less likable, right? Less of a hero. It makes the monster even more of an innocent.
Yeah.
I really liked what they did with the Elizabeth character. Instead of making her just the object of Victor's affection, which she is, but not in the same way, right? She was just window dressing, essentially, in the original novel.
Yeah.
And like,
I think in like every adaptation, basically, too. She was kind of just a throwaway female character.
Yeah.
But not so much in this, which is great.
Yeah. Well, what's different about her?
she's not vapid. And she has some sort of, like, you know, self-will and determination. And
she's willing to talk politics at the dinner table.
She's interested in science and from, you know, yeah. I mean, I don't know, just interested in science,
yeah.
Yeah. You know, and she's doing her own, she's buying her own books and, you know, creating her own little, insectology, whatever that's called.
Yeah, well, and reading them as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And she's really observant, right? Because, like, there's the confessional scene where Victor goes in there and poses as the priest. Yeah. And she totally
can't pull one over on me. Yeah.
So he's totally perving on her. And so he chases her into a confessional because he wants to, you know, find out her innermost secrets. And she's
like,
I saw you.
Yeah.
And I hate you.
Yeah.
And she's very empathetic and compassionate, but not in a stupid way, I would say.
Yeah. In a way, I think she's like the anti-Victor.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So they might be matches intellectually, but when it comes to character and ethics, she's the complete opposite.
She sees right through him.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. There was something I noticed, and I'm wondering if it's just me that picked it up on it. So maybe it's just a personal thing versus a tonal thing was.
Sure.
Do you notice how she's the brightest dressed thing in the entire movie?
Mm.
Just like the butterflies in the cages.
Mm-hmm. Oh, interesting.
So I wonder if that was like a statement about her captivity and how she was trapped.
I noticed that too. And her colors changed depending on the mood and the what was going on in the rest of the scene too.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah. And then
she always had that blood red rosary on her on her neck.
Yeah.
Mm. Maybe not a rosary, but blood red necklace, beaded necklace with a cross. I don't think it was quite a rosary, but anyway, you get the point.
Yeah.
Yeah, because she went from wearing like these blood red, dark red, all dark red dresses and a hat to sometimes being green with a little bit of yellow, but it all kind of like matched the scene that they were in, whether emotionally matching it or physically matching it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm curious, very cool. like I feel like in all the other adaptations of Frankenstein, Elizabeth gets fridged, right? She's there to be the object of affection and then to be killed to drive the plot forward.
Right,
right.
Where here, she is killed. But she's killed in a self-sacrificial kind of thing.
Very differently.
Stepping in front of a bullet for the monster.
Yeah.
And I like the fact that the movie is pretty, I'm not sure if it's subtle, but like the way animals react to the monster, they're not afraid of him.
No.
He feeds the stag, right? And the mice just come right up to him. And like, he wouldn't hurt a fly, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, the wolves.
The wolves, yeah.
Well. The wolves were attacking him, though. So
yeah, they were really no different from the rest of the villagers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
Right. Yeah, wolves are wolves. Kind of emblematic of the rest of humanity.
Yeah,
in a lot of ways. And yeah, I like the sort of more innocent, gentle aspect to him, but he has that possibility of rage, right?
Yeah, yeah. And I think it plays well for this kind of a story. Mm-hmm. I especially like it because it positions it completely the opposite of the cultural understanding of, Frankenstein's monster.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Right? He's not green. He doesn't have bolts sticking out of him. He's intelligent and well-spoken toward the end.
Right. Eloquent.
But not quickly enough for Victor.
Yeah.
Well, not quick enough right off the bat. Yeah, he's still got a... That's what I thought was ironic about him bringing him back the way that he did and not being prepared. He even said this. He wasn't prepared for what came next.
Yeah.
He just wanted to bring something back to life, conquer death. He didn't really think about what to do afterward.
Yeah. Well, it's the ultimate realization of the phrase, right? You were so obsessed about if you could do it, you didn't decide if you should do it.
Yeah.
Can I do it? Should I do it?
Oh, mm-hmm. Jurassic Park.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, the Christoph Waltz character was bankrolling him for a very specific purpose.
Mm-hmm.
I may ask you a favor one day, right?
Right.
He had that favor in mind from the very beginning.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And so it would have been a very different movie if they ended up putting his brain in the monster. And then you could have gone, okay, syphilitic brain monster goes crazy and kills a bunch of people. That kind of makes sense.
Yeah.
But I preferred it this way. Like it, this movie absolves the monster of a lot of stuff from the book.
Well, yeah, I think the book makes the point that the monster is driven to his extremes because of his inability to be part of society, and he did not ask to be created, and he asked, I found him sympathetic, even though he was doing horrible, awful things to get his demands made, which is what he learned from Victor Frankenstein.
Right,
so.
Right. Where here, you know, there are a couple of the same characters who are killed, like William, but it's, you know, in this, it's more self-defense, right? Everyone's attacking him.
The monster.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Rather than just, you know, I'm going to kill William and frame Justine for it, like in the book.
This movie reminded me, I don't remember if I said this in our first recording of Frankenstein, but I remember being surprised upon reading the book how eloquent the monster actually ended up being as a counter to our pulp culture interpretation you just mentioned.
Yeah.
About, you know, just a shambling monster with bolts in his head. Yeah. Neck.
Yeah. I mean, you do get a little bit of that initially because all he says is the single word Victor.
Right.
Sure. Like any child would, though, right? I mean...
Yeah, and it just takes a little bit of patience for him to start acquiring language at the shack.
Victor right? just had none.
Where he's the spirit of the forest.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Which is right from the book again.
It is, yeah. And the kindness of the old man, right, who says to him, you know, I will be your friend.
Yeah.
Which I really like. And it's a longer sequence with that, where he knows the old man and stays with him. And I enjoyed that difference, because in the book, essentially the moment he tries to reveal himself to the old man, the kids come back and are horrified and drive him off.
Yeah.
And so that's one more step on his radicalization, right?
Yeah.
It makes me wonder why he would have thought that the creature would have came out like, maybe with an adult brain or something, I guess.
Well, you thought about it, if you thought of the brain like a hard drive,
yeah,
then it should be that person's brain.
It would reboot to whatever his last known state was.
Yeah. Right. Although it appears like the jumpstart wipes it, so.
Yeah. What I'm thinking, though, is it's all through. So when he was, like when they were combing the battlefield, he was looking for a particular set of legs because he was going to take advantage of long legs that were easy to work on versus smaller legs.
Yeah, yeah.
Presumably.
I'm looking for a large body to help with the problems of scale.
That's straight out of the book, though.
Yeah.
That's the reason for the gigantic stage.
He never. We never saw you talk about what kind of brain do you want to get?
Right.
Abnormal brain? or normal brain? There was never any mention of him actually looking for... you would have thought maybe he would look for a particular type of brain at some point.
There was no trip to the book depository. Or brain depository.
Brain depository. No. Brain depository. But even so, yeah. Right?
But in the book, doesn't he go to somebody's grave in particular to get a brain from a philosopher, scientist?
No. No.
No?
Mm-mm. That's okay. that's young Frankenstein.
Yeah.
At the brain depository.
Right.
I must be confusing it with something. Maybe one of the other movies. It could be. I would swear.
Yeah.
But I'm just thinking, if he would have expected the brain to come out at the last known good state.
Yes. Right.
Wouldn't you have picked a brain that you would have been reliably know it would come out in a state preferential state? Right?
Sure.
Versus, you know, then he becomes totally surprised that something different happened. Like, well, what the hell did you think was going to happen?
So you're saying this is part of our robot series?
Basically.
Yeah.
Artificial life? Automaton? Yeah. Kind of? Yeah.
Okay, so I had been thinking to myself in the lead up to this, and as I was listening to the book, that I don't like a hard science fiction aesthetic with Frankenstein, right? Because I don't buy it.
Right. Just like in the original recording 10 years ago.
Yeah. And I said it. And then when I was listening to it, I was like, okay. So I'm consistent on that.
Yeah.
Because that's kind of what I think. Because the more you try and get into it, the less I believe it. Right. I liked the way they did it here, where they were kind of looking a little beyond science, kind of like in the original book, where he's looking at Paracelsus and other people. And they were essentially like looking for like meridians and chi or something.
Right. Right.
And so that gave it just a little, enough of a different twist that I was like, all right, I'll allow it. The art design of his lab was off the charts.
Right? Oh,
with the big galvanic cells and stuff. And I thought they were like Leyden jars, which is one of the early batteries.
Right.
Yeah, really, really cool. And of course, it still used lightning because that's the common thing in everything except the book.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the thing I mentioned earlier about there are nice nods to other things.
Yeah.
And that's a nice nod to the 1931 movie, mm-hmm. using lightning. And it kind of gives a framing narrative for him to perv on Elizabeth while William is there busy building the giant electric, you know, lightning rod and everything else.
Right.
Yeah. And, you know, he's kind of attracted to her mind, right? Because she's not just an empty-headed person, right? Not just there for window dressing.
Yeah.
But like, she just never really entertains it at all. And I think that drives Victor a little crazy. And then, of course, the first time she sees the monster, you know, she's this very empathetic person. And the first thing she notes is that he's hurt, right? She notices his wounds. And so I really liked that compassion in that character.
Although her affectation is just a little, there's not a lot of warmth in Elizabeth. right? She's a very prim and proper, distant Victorian woman, I think.
Right.
And I think maybe that's what I was picking up on. I don't know.
Yeah, she was a little distant almost the entire time.
Oh, I didn't see her that way with the monster. With Victor and with William, yes.
Yeah.
But it seemed like she had a connection to the monster. She somehow recognized the monster as a kindred spirit. And she rejected the Victor calling it an it, right?
Right.
Like, it's a man. You have made a man, a person.
Did we look under the skirt?
No.
That's true. He's always got the tidy whities on. So.
That's right.
He might not be fully equipped.
Right.
We don't know.
We don't know.
Although I thought it's when she went down there.
I thought at one point we were going to find out, but we didn't.
Yeah. When she went down to visit him in her nightclothes, I thought, okay, well, this could go. Because I had predicted that there was going to be a monster and Elizabeth monster right off into the sunset together.
Right.
Oh. Wow.
But evidently not.
No. I mean, even though there were changes, like you said, you know, the monster's more set, more sympathetic, and Victor is less, if you could do that, right? Yeah. I mean, between the lies and the hiding of things and the covering up, I mean, I guess this Victor is more actively evil by, you know, he shoots people and he kills people and then hides it. And although he kept the body, you know what he was thinking.
Mm-hmm.
The shopping the hangman's noose was crazy.
Yeah. He smells that guy's breath.
That was hilarious. Like,
you're lucky. You're
he would have been dead in a year.
Yeah.
That was hilarious. He's like, I got this one. Strong back. I like it.
But I love the fact they use the framing narrative.
Yes.
And I really liked it. So, you know, we're in general, Seth does not like voiceovers. And I don't think James and I matter quite as much. Mm-hmm. But a framing narrative is a good way to do an exposition dump without having the voiceover and everything.
Yeah.
Bringing the monster into the room with the captain and Victor is an incredible way for the other half of the story to be told.
Yeah.
Because otherwise you're kind of wondering, so when Victor is telling the story to the captain, how does he know what happened to the monster?
Right.
That transition was fantastic.
Yeah.
Between part one and part two.
Yeah.
It was really cool.
That was good stuff. Because in the book, you have Victor relating all of this to the ship captain, including the part where he met up in the Alps with the monster and the monster told him his whole story.
Right.
So he gets it secondhand from Victor, right? And that's where the unreliable narrator thing comes in, right?
Yes. Yep. This is what the monster told. The monster.
Yes. Yeah. I like that as well. I don't mind the voiceover because I know that it's being someone's telling their tale, right? So that works just fine. Yeah, the framing narrative, right? It starts off on the ice.
Yeah, and it ends on the ice, just like in the movie.
That's how you know he wasn't going to run away to South America with Frankenbride. Ruin that theory.
How do you guys feel about the ending? Because if you were going to talk about a point of canonicity that is very different, that's, I think, the biggest difference.
The reconciliation of them.
The reconciliation instead of the ongoing chase into the Arctic.
Right.
Well, it wasn't an ongoing chase because Victor died. Victor dies in the book. As well, it's just the difference is here.
Right.
They have their moment of catharsis together.
Yeah,
right. Where the monster forgives him for the whole thing, and I thought it was beautiful.
Yeah,
I liked it. I thought it played well on two points. One is he learned it showed him grow a growth point, right? And he learned it from the old guy that died from the wolves.
Yeah.
So I liked that he was taught empathy and forgiveness and was able to show that he grew by actually forgiving Victor in the end.
Yeah, well, and Victor has clearly grown as well.
Right.
Somewhat, right? In his extremity, he realizes, I did wrong here. This is all at my doorstep. Please forgive me. So, I thought that was really cool.
And it's too bad it couldn't have happened earlier.
Yes.
Right.
That's always the way it is, right? There's
wouldn't have been much of a movie if it happened earlier.
Like at the end of A Christmas Carol, right? God forgive me for the time I've wasted.
Yeah. Right? So, you know, it's a redemption story. Really for both of them, because the monster never goes to, you know, awful extremes to get what he wants. And Victor, redeems himself asking for forgiveness in the end.
Yeah.
And
he wreaks great destruction upon the sailors when he first arrives there. But they're trying to kill him.
And the captain no longer wants to do their stupid mission north and just head home.
Yeah. I think that's out of the book, too, isn't it?
It is in the book.
Yeah.
He learns the lesson from Victor.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And obsession is.
It's very explicit here in the movie that, I heard a story about the way I was heading and we're turning around.
We're going to go. Yeah.
And the monster gives a little push by.
Yes. Yep. Now, okay. Physics brain, engineering brain. Is yep. like, how thick is that ice? Because if you're pushing into the boat is pushing into you and therefore into the ice.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So, yeah, that doesn't work, but it's fine.
Right. No, in fact, he shouldn't have been able to have enough purchase against the ice to make that kind of leverage.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, even if he had enough grip, right, the ice would have to be so thick in order to, because he's pushing thousands of, yeah. probably hundreds
tons,
of tons, right?
Tons.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And that's going to break the ice.
Yeah.
The ice is thin enough to get shattered by a blunderbuss, mm-hmm. right? Being fired.
In that spot.
Yes. That was a very,
right.
It was a very cool weapon.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was. Yeah.
So we have, you turn off that part of the brain because it's reanimating corpses. So,
yeah. Right.
It's okay.
From there, when you get to rotating blunderbusses, it's not that far.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, yeah, I saw on Letterboxd somebody put a 5-star review for the movie and said Netflix should back up a truck of money to Del Toro and have him reboot all of the Universal monsters. And I'm like, you know what? I'd go for that.
I would love to see what he does with like Bram Stoker's Dracula or something like that.
Yeah.
Del Toro's Dracula.
Yeah, or the Mummy, you know, a new, better version of the Mummy, or the Creature from the Black Lagoon. I mean, Creature from the Black Lagoon is almost covered by The Shape of Water, I think. It's a fish man.
So, but why reboot? Well, I guess he did this so well. Why not do a reboot? But then why not do something creative and incredible and new?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, he does that, right? I mean, he Pan's Labyrinth.
Yeah.
Yeah,
he's already done that.
I haven't actually seen it, so I need to watch that one. I loved his Pinocchio from a couple years ago.
If only Pacific Rim was adapted.
Is that on your list for movies we wish were adapted?
I would throw it on there. I mean, it's not bad.
Big dumb robot movie.
Yep, pretty much.
Yeah.
I have a Guillermo del Toro quote to share.
Okay.
What I find beautiful is that when you create a universal myth, whether it's Frankenstein, Pinocchio, Dracula, or Sherlock Holmes, the myth itself rises so far above the original material that any interpretation is equally faithful if done with sincerity, power, and personality. If you think in terms of fidelity to the canon, you would be completely paralyzed.
Mm.
Which one is one of the more interesting, you know, statements about that, given how highly canonical this is,
yeah,
right,
and how awesome the result is. Now, whether that's it's a question of who made it versus the source material, or the combination of the
two,
think
of both, yeah, about the blending of both, yeah, it can't just be one or the other,
yeah, and I think, you know, he's talking very much about trying to tell a new story that's been told so many times, right? That you can't hold yourself to the canon because the canon is so vast,
yeah.
And so anything.
Well, yeah, it's like what we were saying. It's like our cultural reference, right? I mean, culturally,
yeah.
The big dumb monster with bolts in his neck is the canon.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there is another Frankenstein adjacent movie coming out. Is it coming out this year? It might be. We got a trailer for it. Ethan and I went and saw Shelby Oaks, and we got a trailer for The Bride, where Jesse Buckley is playing the bride and Christian Bale is playing the monster. And his monster is very styled like. Whatever the Frankenberry cereal is, right?
Right.
Like it looks like that with kind of the square head.
Oh,
yeah. And it looks like it's Monster Bonnie and Clyde. It looks kind of fun, actually.
Okay.
Jesse Buckley's awesome. But yeah.
But it's Frankenstein.
Yeah. Yeah. Where does this fit in your, you know, we've ranked stuff before, right? And we chose to let each other rank whatever you wanted to rank. Where James went, Young Frankenstein and then book.
Right. I think it was just Young Frankenstein.
I think it was, yeah.
Yeah, I looked at the rankings online. It was just Young Frankenstein.
Yeah. So, yeah, where does this one rank in your... where does this one Frankenstein?
Gosh.
I think it's my favorite adaptation.
Better than Young Frankenstein?
I think it's a better movie than Young Frankenstein, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think
allowing for the fact that Young Frankenstein isn't actually an adaptation of Frankenstein.
Yeah, yeah, it's a parody.
It's a sequel.
So yeah.
It's a sequel parody.
Yeah. Gosh.
Yeah. And I would say I'd probably go watch this over read the book again. So probably better than the book, but not to discount the book. It should definitely be read. But yeah, I would go movie book on this one.
Yeah. So if we set aside the parodies and the other special cases, I think I would definitely say 2025 book 1931.
Yeah. Yeah. I would completely agree.
Yeah.
I mean, I really enjoy the book and I enjoyed my re-listen to it, but I thought this was everything that I was hoping for. Like it was different in a couple of ways that where I was like, that adaptation makes sense. You know, like in terms of the story that he's trying to tell here and to set up that moment of reconciliation between them, you had to have the monster be more sympathetic. And maybe you gave Victor a little more distance to go because he was kind of awful.
Yeah.
So it gave him a good arc.
Instead of tacitly awful, he was actively awful.
Right. Well, because in the book, it's like I won't say innocently created the monster, right? But he freaked out when the monster woke up and he was horrified at its yellow eye. And then kind of ran away from his responsibility the rest of the book.
Right.
And then made a bad bargain with the monster to make a mate, and then filched on his responsibility in that case on what he promised to do. And so all these consequences were a direct result of his own action or inaction. Where here he's just a little more terrible the whole time.
Yeah, I mean the fight with him and Christoph Waltz, that wasn't a huge thing. It was, he died accidentally. Hiding the death, that was something.
Yeah. And using the death as a false flag, you know, to say the monster did this.
Oh yeah. It's always the monster's fault.
Yeah.
Right. Who killed Elisabetta? It was the monster. Mm-hmm. Who killed your uncle? It was the monster.
Yeah. Yeah.
Whereas the book Frankenstein never owned up to the monster and blamed everything on other things.
Mm-hmm. That sounds familiar.
All right. I think we're wrapped then since we've ranked them.
Yeah.
Completed our double dip for the month. And next month we got a trailer for The Running Man in our theater.
Yeah. 2 weeks.
Looks like they're going to hit a lot of stuff from the actual book, which is cool.
I know. Right. Yeah. This looks like an actual adaptation. Yeah.
So it should be fun. So let us know, you know, have you watched the movie already? You know, we're recommending you go out and do it if you can, while it's still in theaters near you. If not, then catch it on Netflix next month and let us know what you thought, because we all liked it. And that's not always what happens.
No.
So. Right.
All right. Bye, everybody. Oh, may the road rise up to meet you. And don't reanimate corpses. All right. Yeah. Bye, everybody.
Ciao.